Last week we saw that after three kings that governed the United Kingdom of Israel with all 12 tribes together, Saul, David, and Solomon, we see that God split up the kingdom. And God did so in judgment of the sin of Solomon, of Solomon not remaining faithful to God as he was called to be. Today we're going to continue on and see, well, the next kings in both of those kingdoms now. We now have two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And we'll see what directions these kingdoms head. Do they remain, do they turn back to the faithfulness of David? Do they remain in the limited faithfulness of Solomon? Or do they head even worse and turn away from God entirely? And we'll see that this week and in the coming weeks. We'll also see today what God does in response to the faith or lack thereof of these people in sending Elijah. Now let's remind ourselves first, why was it that God split up the kingdom? Well, I mentioned it was the faithlessness or limited faithfulness of Solomon. We see that at the beginning of chapter 11 of 1 Kings. It says that King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. We've heard about Pharaoh's daughter at various points in the story. He loved Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites and Sidonians and Hittites. These were all from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites that you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. But nevertheless, even though God had commanded that not only for the people of Israel but also for the king, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives, okay, huge number, of royal birth, meaning they were daughters of kings or granddaughters of kings. Basically, these were political alliances that he formed by marrying into royalty. And he had 300 concubines, and his wives, as God foretold, led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, okay, away from God and towards these other gods, the gods of the countries that they came from, the gods of their families before they joined Solomon's family. And Solomon's heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh, his God, as the heart of David, his father, had been. In fact, going on, it says he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow Yahweh completely as David his father had done. In fact, on a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh. He's the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. Now you'll hear more about those detestable gods as we continue in our stories in coming weeks. He did the same for all of his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. So God had very clearly made the command, not just back to Joshua's day, not just back in Moses' day, but all the way back to Abraham. He had called his people Israel to be a separate, cut-off people, and not to intermix, not to intermarry, not to interrelate with other peoples, because those other peoples could turn you astray, could lead you from God and turn you towards other gods. The people of Israel were to be a people of God, a people that whose experiences could show the rest of the world who God is and what God does in his love for his people. That as you turn from God, as you follow the ways of others who follow man-made gods, then Israel does not fulfill her destiny. In fact, Israel destroys her destiny of being the light to the rest of the world to point people back to God. So what did God decide to do in judgment against Solomon for this evil? I'll start at verse 9, just where we left off. Yahweh became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep Yahweh's command. So Yahweh said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I have commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Okay, so he was going to turn the kingdom away to one of his servants. However, nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, okay, not because of your faithfulness, but because of the faithfulness of your father David, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but I will give him one tribe, again, for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So because of the faithfulness of David, David being a man after God's heart, sure, David sinned. When we looked at the stories of David, we saw that he sinned. But he repented, and he confessed those sins, and he turned back to God. And we never saw that David worshipped other gods, that David allowed himself to be led astray. He did have problems where he married many wives, and they posed some potential problems, but David remained faithful. Solomon, on the other hand, was tempted by the gods of his wives and turned away. And in judgment, God said, okay, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you. But for the sake of your father David, who was faithful to me, I'll leave one tribe with your family, and I'm not going to do it until your son is king. Okay? So that set the stage that we saw last week. Who was this subordinate, this servant that God said that he was going to choose? Verse 28, it says, now Jeroboam, okay, this is the guy, Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. And you see that that labor force in the previous verse 27, had built the supporting terraces that allowed Jerusalem to grow and expand, and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, which is the southern part of Jerusalem, his father. And so Jeroboam had been in charge of that labor force that did that, and he's the one that God had chosen to give the rest of the kingdom to. And so you see, he was a young man here at Solomon's time. What promise did God make to Jeroboam? Well, going on, we saw this last week in verse 29, you get the story of Jeroboam was just minding his own business, and the prophet Ahijah came up to him and told him that God had chosen him to be the king of 10 of the tribes. And some of the verses here, verse 31, Ahijah says to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. And then verse 38, skipping down to that, he says, if you do, Jeroboam, if you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands as David my servant did, well, then I will be with you. In fact, I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one that I built for David, and I'll give Israel to you. Okay? So he basically gave the same promise, the same opportunities to Jeroboam as he had given to David. And he said, take a look at what I've done for David. Take a look at the relationship David had with me, Jeroboam. You've got the opportunity to be David too. You've got the opportunity to live under my love, live under my blessings, have me with you, guiding and protecting and taking care of you and your kingdom. Just be with me. Accept me. Stay with me. Don't follow other gods. Obey me. Okay? Put your faith in me. That's all he had to do. That was the relationship. The relationship that God had with David, he wanted that kind of relationship with Jeroboam, and said, if you do so, then I will bless you. And I'll build a dynasty for you, like the dynasty I've built for David. So, how faithful was Jeroboam? Chapter 12, verse 26, we see, Jeroboam thought to himself, you know, the kingdom will likely revert back to the house of David. If these people go up to offer their sacrifices at the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem, which happens to be there in the southern tribe in Judah, in the territory of Judah, he says, they will again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me and they'll return to King Rehoboam. So you see, he gets a little nervous about the threat of people going to Jerusalem and being exposed to Judah life and what that means, and that they could turn their allegiance back to Rehoboam and turn away from him. Now, is this part of God's plan? Now, what did God just say? God said, I will be with you. You trust me. You stay with me, Jeroboam, and I'll take care of you. But Jeroboam didn't trust God enough. He didn't trust in God's promise. So what did he do? Verse 28, after seeking advice, the king, Jeroboam, made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." Does that sound familiar? That's what we heard back when Aaron built the golden calf when Moses was up on the Mount Sinai getting God's commands. Okay. Now he took these two golden calves. The reason he did two is because the northern tribes of nation of Israel was pretty extensive, and so he put one way up north in Dan and one down in the south part of the nation in Bethel. Okay. And that way people could go one way or the other to go visit the temple that was closest to them. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan, okay, the one way up in the north, to worship the golden calf there. So he created his own religion. He created these golden calves and set up these idols very clearly against God's word and God's command. And then he even went further. In 31 he says, "Jeroboam built shrines on the high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they weren't Levites." Okay, so he kind of made up his own religion. He made up his own temples, he made up his own shrines, made up his own priesthood. In fact, as you continue reading, you see that he basically would offer priesthood to whoever paid enough money. Whoever wanted to be a priest, they could become a priest if they just paid enough. Not the way that God does things. God chose his priest. Verse 32, he instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, kind of like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. He did this in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made, and at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. And on the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, okay, so he makes up these festivals and feasts and special days, holy days. But on that day, he offered up sacrifices on the altar that he had built at Bethel, and therefore he instituted the festival before the Israelites, and he went up to the altar to make offerings. So he kicks off, he creates this new religion, and tells Israel to follow this religion. We saw last week that the faithful people left. Okay, the true Levites, the true priests, the true believers in the northern tribes of Israel went south and moved to Judah, where Judah was continued faithful to God. So, what did God decide to do in response to Jeroboam for his evil? Chapter 14, verse 7. This is Ahijah the prophet talking to Jeroboam's wife, and he says, "Go tell Jeroboam that this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Jeroboam, I raised you up from among the people, and I made you a leader over my house Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David and I gave it to you, but you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. You have done more evil than all who lived before you. You made for yourself other gods, idols made of metal. You've provoked me to anger and thrust me behind your back. So because of this, I'm going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it's all gone. Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. Yahweh has spoken." That's the way it's going to be. Okay? So you see some harsh judgment, but is it harsh judgment? That's a pretty evil thing that Jeroboam did, because he not only turned away from God himself, but he led the people astray. And he set up his own religion, and he called for the people to turn away from God and to follow these idols and worship these idols. So they were guilty too, because they followed. We saw that the faithful people went south. Well, what did God do in judgment to the people? The people who stayed and people who did turn away from Yahweh and worship these idols that Jeroboam had set up. Verse 15. It says, "Yahweh will strike Israel so that it will be like a reed swaying in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land that he gave to their forefathers and scatter them beyond the river, because They provoked Yahweh to anger by making Asherah poles. And he will give Israel up because of the sins that Jeroboam has committed and has caused Israel to commit. Okay? So Jeroboam led them, but they followed. And so they are guilty as well. And it says that I will basically destroy this nation. I will uproot them from the land and I will scatter them across the big river Euphrates to where they no longer exist as a people. And we'll see as we go on through the studies, it'll be about a month before we get to this point, but we'll see that's exactly what happens a couple hundred years later. So we now see the direction that the northern nation of Israel is heading because of Jeroboam, the direction that he has pointed them on. What about the southern nation? What about Judah? What about Rehoboam? How faithful was Rehoboam, Solomon's son, as king of Judah? Well, turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 6, chapter 12, and you see some of the story of Rehoboam. What you have here is in the Chronicles, you've got the same stories that you have in the Kings, except the Chronicles didn't really care about the northern tribe of Israel. It only looks at the southern tribe of Judah for the most part. And sometimes you find more details and more, even more stories in the Chronicles than what you might find in the Kings. So sometimes it's good to kind of bounce back and forth. Sometimes you'll find the exact same verbiage and wording, so they use some of the same sources to compile these letters. But turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 12, and you see that after Rehoboam's position as king was established, and he had become strong, he, and not only he, but also all Israel with him, abandoned the law of Yahweh. So you can see that Rehoboam started out faithful, started out strong, and started out leading God's people in the way that God wants him led. But you see that after he felt secure, after he felt like he was in position and, I don't need God as much anymore, he turned away from God. Okay? He didn't lead the people in the way of the Lord. So that was a problem. What's one of the ways, or in what ways did Rehoboam and the people of Judah abandon God? Turn back to chapter 14 of 1 Kings, and we'll kind of pick things up from there. Verse 22, Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. So we see that they went backwards, and even though we've talked about a little bit of faithlessness on the amount of the people, now they kind of went even worse. And you kind of see in verse 23 that they set up for themselves high places. Okay, high places were the places where the Canaanites had set up shrines and altars and places to worship their little local god. And when the Israelites came into the Promised Land, they were commanded to tear all those down and not to use those facilities for worshiping God. Okay, but we've seen that a lot of those are still around. And in Solomon's day, people started using the Canaanite high places to worship God. Now, this is not saying that worshiping God on a high place, on a hilltop, on a mountaintop is wrong, but rather using a facility that was built for and dedicated to another god and using that to worship God, yeah, that's wrong. And that's what they were doing here. In fact, they set up for themselves, not only would at Rehoboam's time were they using Canaanite high places that were still around, but they set up for themselves other high places, sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. Okay, so they built shrines not to worship God, but to worship these Canaanite gods. In fact, there were even, in verse 24, male shrine prostitutes in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nation that Yahweh had driven out before the Israelites. So all these years had passed, and when the Israelites had come into the Promised Land, they were instructed to wipe them out. Otherwise, those people would be snares to them. They would be temptations to them. And sure enough, you see, hundreds of years later, they are. They're these people who are still around are temptations, and the Israelites are led astray. The people of Judah are engaged in worshiping these detestable gods and these gods of the Canaanites that they were supposed to wipe out. So Rehoboam and the people rejected God. Okay? And what you kind of see is that they probably did both. It wasn't just a matter of saying, okay, it's not God anymore, but it's these Baals, these gods of the Canaanites. But rather, they probably did both, which is just as bad as turning entirely away. Why worship something that is not God, as God? Why put something that's man-made on the same level of God? God does not allow that, just as he does not allow us turning away from him. So how did God respond to Rehoboam's rejection? Verse 25, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, the king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. He carried off the treasures of the temple of Yahweh and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all of the gold shields that Solomon had made. So, in punishment, God sent Shishak to make Rehoboam and Judah subject to Egypt. Now, and you see that Shishak took, he invaded and attacked Jerusalem, and he took all the valuables. Now, we see in 2 Chronicles chapter 12 story, you see that when this happened, Rehoboam and the leaders humbled themselves and accepted this punishment as rightfully due punishment for them turning away from God. And when God saw their confession and repentance, he didn't allow Shishak to destroy them and didn't allow the same punishment to come to them as he had sworn to send to the northern tribe, that they would be eliminated and destroyed and all that. So as a result, they were just made subject, and they lost these valuables, which was still punishment, but not to the extent that it would have been if they had not humbled themselves and been repentant. One other note about Rehoboam's kingship is how well did these divided kingdoms get along while Rehoboam and Jeroboam were around? Chapter 14, verse 30 says that there was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So you see that it got started pretty much in a civil war we saw last week, and that civil war continued throughout the reigns of Jeroboam and Rehoboam and even beyond. But you don't see a continual, full-scale civil war, but rather just a bunch of intermittent skirmishes and an enemy relationship between the two nations during this time. Okay? All right, well, let's talk about some of the next kings. We won't spend as much time on each of these, but the next kings of Judah. So Judah, the southern nation, started out with Rehoboam, Solomon's son. When he died, after he finished, we see in chapter 14, verse 21, that he started when he was 41 years old and reigned 17 years. So he was 58 when he died. And then after he died, who succeeded him and how faithful was this person? So in chapter 15, in the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Okay, so you'll see references when it brings out a new king. It tells you who was king, and it gives you a date, gives you a point of reference based on who was king in the other nation. So you can make yourself a chart that shows who was king when, both in the north and the south, that kind of thing. So in the 18th year of Jeroboam, Abijah became king of Judah. Okay, Abijah was Rehoboam's son. Verse 3, Abijah committed all the sins that his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh his God as the heart of David his forefather had been. So basically, Abijah walked in the sins of his father. He continued on with the faithlessness or the limited faithfulness of Rehoboam. Now, where did he come from? To what royal line did Abijah's mother belong? Verse 2 says that Abijah was only king for 3 years, and his mother's name was Maacah, and she was the daughter of Abishalom. Well, Abishalom is the same as Absalom. Okay, it's just the same name, just a variant of how you would pronounce it. So his mother was a descendant of Absalom, and if you look elsewhere, you see basically she was a granddaughter of Absalom, and thereby David's great-granddaughter. She would have been Rehoboam's second cousin, is the way all this works out. So Rehoboam had married his second cousin, and that's who was the mom of Abijah. So did God decide to wipe out Abijah's family as he had decided to do for Jeroboam's family because of the faithlessness and continuing to follow other gods? Verse 4. Nevertheless, for David's sake, okay, David's faithfulness, you see it, it continues on to many generations, the blessings that God gives as a result of his faithfulness. For David's sake, Yahweh his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem by raising up a son to succeed him and by making Jerusalem strong. So no, God did not wipe out Abijah's family. Instead, he allowed the dynasty to continue for the sake of David's faithfulness. Okay? Because David had done what was right in verse 5 in the eyes of the Lord and did not fail to keep any of the Lord's commands all the days of his life except for that case of Uriah the Hittite. Okay? We also see in verse 6 that there was continued warfare between Rehoboam or Abijah now during Abijah's lifetime and Jeroboam. Okay? Between the northern and southern kingdoms during there. In fact, you can see an interesting story of some of this warfare in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. So, kind of guide you there to take a look and see for yourself. Interesting story. All right. What about after Abijah? Who followed Abijah as king of Judah and how faithful was he? Verse 9. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king of Judah. Okay. And Asa was Abijah's son. Okay. His grandmother's name was Maacah. It says there in verse 10. So you see that. Asa, however, did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh as his father David had done. So he reversed the trend. He reversed the direction that Rehoboam and Abijah had started and turned himself, turned the nation, turned Israel, or turned Judah back to faithfulness in God. Okay? He followed the ways of his great-grandfather David. So, how did he work to reform the evils of his father and his grandfather? Going on, verse 12. Asa expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land. Okay, we saw that that had started back in Rehoboam's time. Okay, that's kind of a big thing. You've got something that's been happening for a couple generations, and then he changes all that. His grandfather allowed this stuff to happen, but he stopped it all. He expelled these male shrine prostitutes from the land, and he got rid of all the idols that his father and his grandfather had made. He even deposed his grandmother Maacah from her position as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Asa cut the pole down and burned it in the Kidron Valley. So you see, he's not even afraid to stand up against his grandmother, the queen mother, and he deposed her because she followed Asherah. She had made this Asherah pole. We'll talk a little bit about what Asherah is in a little bit. So you see that his reform stretched out. And in fact, if you turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 15, you can see more description of some of the reforms that he did to return Judah to faithfulness in God. So did he remain faithful all his life? Now the best picture of this is in 2 Chronicles. So turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 16. And it was during Asa's reign that the kingship kind of changed in the northern time. And we see in chapter 16, Baasha is the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, in this story. And it says, in the 36th year of Asa's reign, Baasha, the king of Israel, went up against Judah and fortified Ramah to prevent anyone from leaving or entering the territory of Asa, the king of Judah. So he kind of put up a Berlin Wall kind of thing. Asa then took the silver and gold out of the treasuries of the Lord's temple and out of his own palace and sent it to Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who was ruling in Damascus. And he said, let there be a treaty between me and you as there was between my father and your father. See, I'm sending you silver and gold. Now break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. Zoom down to verse 7. At that time, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Aram and not on Yahweh your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hand. Okay, the eyes of the Lord, verse 9, range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to Him. You have done a foolish thing, and from now on, you will be at war. Now, Asa had seen an earlier threat that you see in chapter 14 of 2 Chronicles. You might want to look at that on your own, where he was overpowered by an army of Cushites, which are really basically Egyptians, and God gave him a great victory because God did it. He trusted God there. He turned to God for help, and God gave him the help. But now, when he was threatened by nowhere as strong of a threat from Baasha, the king of Israel, instead of turning to God and trusting God, he instead looks to the king of Syria, the king of Aram, for help. Syria, or Aram, was on the other side of the northern tribes. So by allying with them, he's got an enemy on both sides, himself on the southern side and Aram on the northern side of Israel. And he pays more to the king of Syria to be an ally and to fight against the northern tribes than what the north had paid him. Okay, so you see that he trusted Aram more than he trusted God. Okay, and as a result, the judgment was that, okay, the rest of your reign is going to be filled with warfare. So here he had such a great start, and really for the most of his time, he was faithful. But when push came to shove, towards the end of his reign, he didn't follow through in trust and faith with God. Instead, he turned to someone else, and that put a black mark on his faithfulness. Those are the kings of the southern kingdom that we'll cover today. We'll stop with the southern kingdoms there. And let's turn back to the northern kingdom and see, okay, who were kings there at these times? Chapter 15, after Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam had been king. In fact, if you want to follow along, you can take a look at the table on page 4. And you can see the left side of the table is what we've just talked about with Rehoboam, the southern kings. Rehoboam ruling for 17 years, and he was bad mostly, okay, because he turned away from God and turned the people away from God. And that was followed by his son Abijah, who was bad mostly, followed in his father's footsteps, walked in the ways of his father in terms of faithlessness, and he reigned for 3 years. You see, Asa, though, was good and turned the people back, and God allowed him to reign for 41 years. Okay. Now, during Asa's time is when Jeroboam died. And we've already seen that Jeroboam was faithless. Let's look at the others, and you can kind of follow along on that page. But let's see what the Bible has to say. Who succeeded Jeroboam as king of Israel, and how faithful was he? Verse 25, chapter 15. Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the ways of his father and in his sin that he had caused Israel to commit. So Nadab, Jeroboam's son, succeeded Jeroboam, and he walked in the faithless ways of his father, continued those sins that his father had started. So it says here that he reigned only 2 years. Why is that? Going on, verse 27. Baasha, which the same Baasha that we read about just a minute ago with the story with Asa. But Baasha, son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, plotted against him, and he struck him down at Gibbethon, which is a Philistine town, while Nadab and all of Israel were besieging it. Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of Asa, king of Judah. So this is early in Asa's reign, and succeeded him as king. So you see that Nadab was assassinated and succeeded by Baasha. So that's why he only ruled for 2 years. So how did this, what's the deal about this? How did this fulfill God's promise of punishment to Jeroboam? Going on. As soon as he began to reign, he killed Jeroboam's whole family. He did not leave Jeroboam anyone that breathed, but destroyed them all. According to the word of the Lord that was given through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite, which we saw back in chapter 14, because of the sins that Jeroboam had committed and had caused Israel to commit, and because he provoked Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger. So the judgment that God had pronounced through the prophet Ahijah against Jeroboam and his family, that his family would be destroyed because he had turned the people away from God and created this religion and these idols and you know, rejected God, you see that Baasha fulfills that prophecy, fulfills that judgment. by destroying Jeroboam's family. All right, how faithful was Baasha? Verse 33. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, different Ahijah, became king of all of Israel in Tirzah. Tirzah is where the capital of the northern kingdom was at this time. And he reigned for 24 years. So you see that on page 4, that he was there for 24 years. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. So Baasha just continued on. He did evil in God's eyes. He walked in the ways of Jeroboam. The whole reason that God had turned it over to Baasha was in judgment of Jeroboam for leading the people astray. And Baasha does the same darn thing. So how did God decide to punish Baasha for this evil? Chapter 16. Then the word of Yahweh came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha. I lifted you up from the dust, and I made you leader of my people Israel. Sounds a little familiar. We've heard that before. But you walked in the ways of Jeroboam and caused my people Israel to sin and to provoke me to anger by their sins. So I'm about to consume Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like that of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Dogs will eat those belonging to Baasha who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. So the same pronouncement, the same judgment that God had pronounced on Jeroboam and his family was being pronounced on Baasha and his family. So his family would be destroyed because of his evil, because of his rejection of God, because of continuing to lead the people to faithlessness and to worship other gods. So what happened then? After he died, who succeeded him? Verse 8. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Elah, son of Baasha, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah for 2 years. So Baasha was when he died, the kingdom was taken over by his son Elah. But there we see again, he reigned for 2 years. Why? Going on. Zimri, one of his officials who had command of half of his chariots, plotted against him. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the home of Arza, the man in charge of the palace at Tirzah. Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, the king of Judah. Then he succeeded him as king. So one of his servants, a man who commanded half of the chariot force, decided he wanted to be king. And so he goes and he assassinates Elah. And so that's why Elah's only king for a couple of years. Well, how did Zimri fulfill God's promise of punishment to Baasha? Verse 11, as soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne, he killed off Baasha's whole family. He did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. So Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord that was spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu, which we just read at the beginning of chapter 16, because of all the sins that Baasha and his son Elah had committed and had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. So Zimri fulfilled God's pronouncement of judgment against Baasha and his family, that he would destroy his family just as he had destroyed Jeroboam's family. And there you see, Zimri did it. All right. How long did Zimri reign as king? Another 20-something years like Baasha did? Verse 15. In the 27th year of Asa, the king of Judah, Zimri reigned in Tirzah 7 days. 7 days. The army was encamped near Gibbethon, a Philistine town. When the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel that very day in the camp. Okay. Then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. So you see that Zimri didn't necessarily have all the support. He just did this. He just went and assassinated the king and decided he's going to be king. Well, he didn't necessarily have the support. When word got to the army that happened to be besieging Gibbethon, this Philistine town, they decided, well, who's this Zimri guy? He's not our king. Omri's our king. Omri, our commander. That's where the force is, right? The army's got the force, and the army can decide who can be king. And they decided that Omri was going to be king. So they went and laid siege to Tirzah to kill Zimri. Well, how was the siege ended? Verse 18. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace and set the palace on fire around him. So he died. So Zimri killed himself. He saw that his situation was hopeless. So rather than waiting it out and receiving any kind of torture or whatever that Omri and the army might want to put on him for killing the king, he kills himself. And he says, hey, if I can't have the palace, neither can anyone else. So he burns it down, burns it to the ground, and dies in there. All right, who becomes king next? Well, verse 21, you would think Omri, right? Well, the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half of them supported Tibni, a son of Ginath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. Okay, so we've got this, Omri seems like he would be the king because he's got the army there, and he's the one who got Zimri to stop being king. But there's a bunch of people who support this guy named Tibni. But, verse 22, Omri's followers, which included the armed forces, proved stronger than those of Tibni, the son of Ginath. So, Tibni died, and Omri became king. I like the way that's put. It's just kind of a matter of fact. So, Tibni died. It's just the way it was. But Omri became the next king. During this time, something interesting happened. Verse 24, it says that he bought the hill, that is, Omri bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver, okay, which is about 150 pounds of silver, and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria, after Shemer. Okay, Samaria is Shemaria. Okay, the name of the former owner of the hill. So, why did he do this? Well, the capital was in Tirzah, and that's where the palace was, but you know what? There's no palace anymore. Zimri just burned it down. So, you know what? That palace has been around for a few years. You gotta start from scratch. Rather than going and rebuilding there, maybe it's landlocked, who knows what, but he decides he's gonna build a whole new capital city. And so there's this hill, and he buys it from the guy who owns it and names it after the guy. And that's where the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel remained from that time on, is in the city of Samaria on this hill of Shemer. In fact, the people of the northern tribe were often referred to as people of Samaria or Samaritans. Okay, and so that's where you see that that got started. All right, Omri, how faithful was his reign? Did he turn things better? Verse 25. But Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Nope, he didn't make it better. Going on. And sinned more than all those before him. So he not only didn't make it better, he made it worse. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. So he was even more evil than all the kings before him. So, not really heading in the right direction. Meanwhile, you see that in the southern kingdom, they're heading in the right direction, right? Asa made things better, but Omri makes things worse. So things are going down, getting worse in the northern kingdom of Israel. They're getting better in the southern kingdom of Judah. All right. Omri was around for a dozen years, and then who succeeded him, and how faithful was this guy? Verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, so Asa's still king in Judah, okay, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. So here we see a long-term king here, 22 years, and it was Omri's son Ahab. Well, how good did he do? Did he turn the tide and turn things better? No, it says, verse 30, Ahab, the son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of Yahweh than any of those before him, including Omri. So you thought Omri was bad because he was worse than all the others. Well, Ahab was even worse. In fact, Ahab is recognized as being the absolute worst of all the kings anywhere in terms of turning the Israelites, turning God's people away from him. In fact, let's look at that. How was Ahab more evil than those before him? Verse 31. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, okay, that bad stuff that Jeroboam got his whole family wiped out for doing, and Baasha too. Oh, that's nothing. Let me show you what I can do, he says, you know. But what his biggest downfall is that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians. Okay, remember we talked a few weeks ago about Hiram, the king of Tyre. Well, Tyre is right next to the town, the city called Sidon. And so the king of Sidon was Ethbaal. And so Ahab married his daughter. So you have this political marriage. But the problem is that she was very devout in her faith with the Baal of the Sidonians, the Baal of Sidon. And as a result, Ahab, which you will see next week as we get into Ahab's story, that Ahab was really a wet fish. He just didn't have a backbone. And he let his wife make decisions for him, including his faith. Verse 31, because of Jezebel, he began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in the capital city of Samaria. He also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel before him, and I would say pretty much behind him too. He just really blew it and really screwed it up. So he trivialized Jeroboam's sin, he married Jezebel, and by doing so brought in Baal worship and Asherah worship. So instead of just having the Jeroboam worship and worshiping the made-up gods of Jeroboam, he leads Israel to start worshiping Baal and Asherah of the Sidonians, which are detestable, and you'll hear more about it as we go on. Now, when he started this Baal worship, did he do so to replace Yahweh? Or was this just kind of like what we've seen in the South, to where, okay, you worship Yahweh, but worship Baal also? Well, I'll turn to chapter 18, verse 4. You see that Jezebel was killing off Yahweh's prophets. Okay, and there's this guy named Obadiah who risked his life and took 100 prophets and hid them in caves to protect them. But you can see Jezebel was killing off Yahweh's prophets. She was trying to kill off Yahweh worship, and so you see it was trying to replace God. One other interesting note, in verse 34, there's some other notable construction that happened during Ahab's reign here. It says, in Ahab's time, a guy named Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram. And he set up its gates when he got done with building the city at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, the son of Nun. So during Ahab's reign, the city of Jericho was rebuilt. And the guy who did it, when he did it, as he was laying the foundation, his oldest son died. When he finished the project and put up the gates, his youngest son died. Does that sound familiar to anybody? There's a prophecy that God had spoken through Joshua back in Joshua chapter 6 when after Jericho had been destroyed. And verse 26 says that at that time, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, "Cursed before Yahweh is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son will he lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest will he set up its gates." And here you see it. It happened. And it happened during Ahab's time, during the darkest time of Israel, in terms of the darkest time of being as far away from God as they ever got. That judgment then, that curse that Joshua had stated was fulfilled at this time. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, what's this Baal thing? Because he's worshiping Baal. I mean, how is that any worse than worshiping these gods of Jeroboam that he made up? Well, any worship of any god other than God is bad, and so it's not worse in that regard. But the Baals were especially detestable, and you'll see this as we continue to go on. But the word Baal, you'll see different Baals, because the word Baal just means Lord or God. okay, in lowercase letters. And you'll see people named Baal this, Baal that, because it's just talking, it's just like God. It's kind of like we've seen so far also the word El, E-L. That's the Canaanite word for God. But every locality had its own God, had its own Baal. And so people in a given location would build a high place on a hilltop, on a mountaintop, would build a shrine, build an altar, build a little mini temple kind of thing, a worship place for their God, for their Baal. And the Baal that we're talking about here, though, is the Baal of Sidon, because that's where Jezebel was from. And so when she came into Israel, she brought her worship of the Baal of Sidon. Okay, Sidon is in what we would call Phoenicia. And this particular Baal was considered to be responsible for rainfall. And so you had to keep this god happy if you wanted to have any kind of agricultural crop, so that he would send rain on the earth and let the crops grow. And how do you keep him happy? Well, you keep him happy by, you try to make him happy, and when he's happy, he'll give rain when he mates with his wife, and his wife is Asherah. So these Asherah poles we talked about are these little totem pole kind of things that were dedicated to Asherah, the goddess, the wife of Baal. Astarte is another word for that. One way that you would make him happy and get him to mate with his wife is that you would have sex in the temple, and that would get him in the mood and get them in the mood and get them to mate so that it would rain. So you had these temple prostitutes that would help that happen. Okay, and so there was continual sex in these temples to try to induce, especially when it was dry outside, to try to induce Baal to get happy and make it rain. On extreme conditions and extraordinary conditions, you would find that people would even sacrifice their children to Baal to show how sincere they were for whatever it was that they were trying to get Baal to do. You'd also have self-mutilation by the priests, and they dance around the altar in a frenzy and all that kind of stuff, trying to get Baal to do things. So their worship was there based on trying to get the god, the Baal, to do what they wanted him to do, and they would do things to try to make that happen. Okay, totally different concept than Yahweh, than our God, than the real God. Okay? Well, so Baal of Sidon is the god of rain, right? No. They said he's the god of rain, but he's not the god of rain. God, Yahweh, is the god of rain. So God wants his people to come back to him. So he's got to make this point. Hey, this Baal that you're worshiping is nothing. You say he's the god of rain. He controls the rain. Well, let's just see how well he can control the rain. And so what did he do to prove that he is the god of the rain and of all creation? Chapter 17. He called this guy named Elijah. Okay, now we're going to see Elijah. Elijah the Tishbite. Okay. He's from Tishbe. That's why he's called a Tishbite. And that's in Gilead, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, the area of Gad. And Elijah came to Ahab and said, "As Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve," I don't serve Baal, I serve Yahweh, "there will neither be dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Okay, so God's going to show who's really God here, who's really in control of nature, who's really in control of the rain. And you can worship your Baal all you want, but it's not going to rain until God tells me to tell you so. Okay, so God sends a drought, a long-term drought. It's going to take years, it says here. And that's going to prove who is really in control. And, you know, you see that even with his name Elijah. If you turn to chapter 18, verse 39, we'll look at this story next week, what his name means and the purpose of why he was called. This is after a contest that Elijah has with the Baal prophets that we'll look at. And it says in verse 39, "When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried out, 'The Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God,'" or the word there is Yahweh. Yahweh, He is God. Yahweh, He is God. That's what God was trying to teach them, that Yahweh is God, not Baal. Okay? And Elijah What does Elijah mean? Look at the word. El, the first part means God. And then Yah at the end. Eliyah. Yah means Yahweh. So Elijah says that his name means Yahweh is God. And that was the conclusion that the people came to here. That was the purpose that Elijah was sent, was to show the people that Yahweh is God and not Baal. Well, there's this drought that would start and would last for a few years. So that would make it hard for people to live because there wouldn't be any water, there wouldn't be any crops. Well, what about Elijah? How would God take care of Elijah during this drought? Verse 2, chapter 17. Well, then the word of Yahweh came to Elijah and he said, "Leave here, turn eastward and hide in the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan." Okay, he needs to hide because once this drought starts and people start getting hungry and thirsty, they're going to be on the lookout for Elijah, right? They're going to try to find him and get him to stop the drought. But as long as he's not found, then that's not threatened either. So he says, "Go and hide over here, and you can drink from that brook, the brook there that's in the Kereth Ravine. And I've ordered the ravens to feed you." And you can see in verses 5 and 6, that's what he does. He goes there and stays there. And the ravens bring him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And he drinks from the brook. So he's taken care of during this time of the drought. But you know what? That brook needs a source of water to continue to flow. And eventually that brook dries up. So how does God take care of Elijah when the brook dries up? Verse 7. "Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of Yahweh came to him and said, 'Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon.'" Zarephath is a town outside of Sidon. "And stay there. I've commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food." So God had another plan for Elijah, and he sent him outside of Israel. Okay, when he was at the brook at the Kereth Ravine, that's in Israel on the east side of the Jordan. Now he's being sent away from Israel, and not just outside of Israel, but to Zarephath of Sidon. Who's the god of that area? The same Baal that the Israelites were worshiping under Jezebel now. So he sends him to the home of Jezebel's Baal, okay, and that's where God's great prophet Elijah here has gone to. It's about 10 miles south of Sidon. Well, he goes to Zarephath, and, oh gosh, he's never been there. How does he find this woman? He doesn't know who he's looking for. How hard is it for him to find this woman in Zarephath? Verse 10. "So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a woman was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, 'Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I could have a drink?' As she was going to get it, he called, 'And bring me, please, a piece of bread.'" So as soon as he got to Zarephath, he got to the town gate, and there she was. God had her right there. Okay, he didn't have to go look. He just had to obey God and go to Zarephath, and then God provided her. So he asked her for some water, and she goes to get him some water and asked him for some food. So apparently they had food and water in Zarephath, right? No going on. When he asked her to bring a piece of bread, she says in verse 12, "As surely as Yahweh your God lives." So she recognizes Elijah being a worshiper of Yahweh here. That's interesting. She replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and to make a meal for myself and my son so that we can eat it, and then we're going to die." So had the drought affected Zarephath? Yes. She had nothing. She had no bread to give him. She had not enough flour to even make bread to feed this stranger. Okay? So she said, "Sorry. In fact, I've only got enough for one more meal, and that's what I'm doing right now. So I'm gathering these sticks so I can go and cook what I expect to be our last meal." Okay? Well, how did God use this condition to show his power to this woman? Verse 13, "Elijah said to her, 'Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said. But first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day that Yahweh gives rain on the land.'" So what's he asking her to do here? He's asking her to trust him. He's asking her to put her faith in God.
and to trust that God is going to provide. She knows she has just a tiny bit of flour, a tiny bit of oil that is just enough for her and her son to have a little bit of bread. But now this stranger is telling him to trust him and to go and make him a little cake of bread first and give it to him, and then go make some for her and her son. And that if she does that, and if she believes him and she trusts him, that they'd be provided for until this drought is over. You know? So he's asking her to trust God. So does she have faith in Elijah's promise? Verse 15. She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and for her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of Yahweh spoken by Elijah. So she did trust him. She did have faith in God. She put her trust in Elijah's promise and did as Elijah told her. And as a result, she was blessed with food every day. And Elijah stayed there with her. Well, time went on. Sometime later, it says in verse 17, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. Okay, he got sick. And it got worse and worse. And finally, he stopped breathing. He died. So how does she respond? She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Why did you come here? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" So when he died, she thought it was punishment for her sinfulness. You know, here she's got the great prophet Elijah living in her house. Okay, we'll see as we go on with our stories next week how powerful Elijah's faith was and how faithful and righteous he was. She's got him living in her house, and she sees her sin in contrast to Elijah's faithfulness. And so now when her son dies, she thinks it's punishment for her sinfulness. Okay? So how does Elijah respond to her reasoning here? Verse 19. "Give me your son," Elijah replied. So he took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to Yahweh, "Oh, Yahweh, my God, have you brought tragedy upon this widow that I'm staying with by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to Yahweh, "Oh, Yahweh, my God, let this boy's life return to him." The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son's alive." Okay? So he prayed to God. He asked God to restore the boy to life, and he did. So why had the boy died? Was it to show the woman her sin and to get her to repent? Verse 24. Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now that I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth." Okay? So why did this happen? It happened to show her the power of God, and that God is God, that Yahweh is God. It happened to build her faith, to bring her to faith and strengthen her faith in Yahweh, in God. Now, this is in contrast to common human thinking that we've seen over and over before, and we'll see it again, and that is that, oh, something bad happens, it's got to be a result of something bad that I did. Well, Jesus talks about that. If you turn to John chapter 9, you can see just one example. There's a number of examples that where he talks about it. But in John chapter 9, Jesus is going along and he sees a man blind from birth. His disciples ask him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Okay, so they're trying to reason this out. Now, if the man is blind because of his sin, well, he was blind from birth, so how did he know? You know, how did that happen? You know, the blindness should happen after he sinned, not before he sinned. So maybe he's blind because of his parents' sin, but if that's the case, then why is he being punished? So they were confused by this. So Jesus answered in verse 3, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." So, why do bad things happen? They don't happen directly as a result of a particular sin. Bad things happen as a result of sin. We live in an evil world, and bad things happen as a result of that. But this man was blind not because of a sin, but to show God's work in his life. The boy died to the widow. The son of the widow died not because of her sin, not because of his sin, but to show God's power, to strengthen her faith, to build her up in faith. Okay? So, let's pray. God our Father, we thank you for the stories you give us. We thank you for the lessons that you teach us. We thank you for showing that that you're there even in the bad things, that you can turn all things to your good, and that when things happen, that we're to turn to you and look to you in faithfulness so that you can strengthen us in our faith. You can show us that you're in control. You can build our faith and send us the righteousness of your Son. We thank you for showing us the lessons of the faithfulness and the faithlessness of the kings of Israel and Judah, and how throughout all of that you pronounce your judgment, but you continue to call your people back to you. You even called the great prophet Elijah to do that, to show the people, to remind them that you are God, that you are in control of all things. Rather than just forgetting about them and destroying them immediately, you gave them chance after chance after chance to come back and continue to call them back. And you do that to us as well as we turn from you. We ask you to continue in your mercy and grace to forgive us of those sins, and to strengthen us by your Spirit to be the kind of people that you've called us to be. We pray this in the name of the one who paved the way for us to come back to you, Jesus Christ. Amen.